I'm standing on the main street of Liberal, Kansas. And, you know, this is really just your sort of typical small town.
That's KCUR reporter Esther Honig, who took a trip out to Liberal late last year. It may not be exactly what you picture when you imagine small town Kansas. Latino restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores dot the main boulevard. Immigrants have been transforming this town for the last decade. But in the last 2 years, Liberal received a new influx of immigrants, 156 children, fleeing violence and poverty in Central America. They're known as unaccompanied minors, and they were part of a wave of young people who came to the U.S. from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador starting in 2012. More of them ended up in Liberal than anywhere else in Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be finding out whatever happened to those young people, starting with Esther's story of one young man she met in Liberal, a teenager facing big decisions about his future.
17-year-old Diego from Joyoba, Guatemala, says he came to Liberal a little over a year ago. Living here, he feels he has more freedom.
I say that here is liberty for everyone.
He's still honing his English, but says that here it's safe to play outside. Back home, you have to worry about being robbed or even killed.
In Guatemala, you know, it's a poor place. There isn't money for food. We don't have a lot, and I don't have a dad.
I meet Diego at his home, a small trailer, where he lives with his half-brother and his family of four. Diego is not his real name, but because of his immigration status, we've been asked not to reveal his identity. We talk in his bedroom. A blanket embossed with the image of Our Lady Guadalupe hangs in the window.
I came here because I want to help my mom, and since I'm her oldest son, well, I took the opportunity to come here and study and later look for a job.
A smuggler was hired to bring Diego to the United States. The journey from Guatemala through Mexico took 1 month. Then, crossing into the U.S., he was apprehended by Border Patrol and placed into federal custody, where he was held at a shelter for 1 month. The Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement released Diego to a family member in the U.S., someone who would agree to care for him until his immigration hearing. That's how he was brought to Liberal, where his half-brother has lived for years.
When I saw him, I was so happy. I even cried because I had never seen my brother until I saw him here.
Immigrants like Diego are designated unaccompanied alien children by the federal government and can remain in the U.S. until their scheduled appearance in immigration court. In order to avoid deportation, some may claim asylum or apply for special immigrant juvenile status, which states that they've been neglected, abused, or abandoned by their parents back home. Diego has been waiting over a year for his court hearing. In the meantime, he can't work legally, but he is able to attend high school, something he could not afford to do in Guatemala.
I like the school because that teach me the English.
Okay, give me the fourth one, somebody. What's the fourth one, Marvin?
In a sunny classroom at Liberal High, Diego's ELL teacher, Lori Navarro, reviews idioms for an upcoming test.
Give me a hand, okay? So fine, give me a hand.
There's a wall lined with photos of her students. Each one has written their story of immigration and how they came to Liberal. Navarro says she's had quite a few unaccompanied minors in her classroom.
You think you have it bad, and then you hear everything that they've gone through and then what they're still going through here.
Like many of these young immigrants, Diego is in debt and says he must repay the nearly $3,000 he owes for the smuggler he hired in Guatemala. Navarro says that unaccompanied minors like Diego are often pressured into working.
They have to work to provide financially because they're not living with their parents, and they also have to send money back, and then they have to pay for their attorneys.
Unaccompanied minors are not appointed lawyers by the government, but without a lawyer, it's really hard to sort out their legal status, and representation in these cases can cost as much as $6,000. In Liberal, there's not enough pro bono services to meet the need. And Navarro says immigration court hearings are often held 6 hours away in Kansas City.
We found out, too, you know, that a lot of them pay like $600 to $700 just to get someone to take them to their lawyer, which is in Kansas City.
Navarro says at least half of these students have earned money, working nights under the table, mostly at the local meatpacking plant.
You get our kids who, you know, are here and come to the U.S. to better their lives and make it easier. And yet, you know, they work all night and go to school all day, and some of them probably don't even get that much sleep, and then they're back at work.
I have butterflies in my stomach.
Very good. I have butterflies in my stomach.
The school's social worker, Sarah Carrillo, has spent the last decade working with many immigrant families who come to Liberal. She's seen the school's demographic change dramatically.
When I came to Liberal in 1989, the school system was 17% Hispanic. It is now 86% Hispanic.
Last year, she started working with large groups of unaccompanied minors and says the issues they face are different from the other immigrant kids that come here with their parents.
The host wants them to drop out of school, get a job, start paying rent. We have kids who are couch surfing from one friend to another.
She says many are living with near strangers, and that leaves them vulnerable to neglect and even human trafficking.
Most of them are with cousins, aunts and uncles, someone from the neighboring village, anyone who will agree to go to the immigration center and sign a paper saying they're responsible for them.
And this has become a national issue. Recent Senate investigations discovered that the government failed to conduct basic background checks on the adults entrusted with caring for these minors. And that has resulted in cases of abuse and even human trafficking. By comparison, Diego, the young immigrant from Guatemala, is lucky. So far, his half-brother has continued to support him, even though the pressure to repay his debt is growing, and that might mean sacrificing his last year of high school.
I would like to graduate, but I owe a lot. And I have to get the money to pay the person who I owe.
Diego says he hopes he'll be granted status in the U.S. He likes it here in Liberal and wants to be able to work legally. But more than anything, he says, he wants the chance to travel back to Guatemala and see his mom.
A lot of people come here and spend 30 years without seeing their mom. And then they go back and their moms aren't alive anymore.
Because that, he says, would be the worst thing imaginable.
Wow, thanks to Esther Honig for bringing us that report. There is so much to unpack. We'll find out what's happening with unaccompanied minors here in Kansas City in just a moment. But first, some context. Let's turn to Garance Burke. She's an investigative reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us, Garance.
Thanks so much for having me.
The boy we're calling Diego has a harrowing story in a lot of ways, but in the course of your investigation for the AP, you discovered lots of teens living in real peril at risk of starvation or being sexually assaulted. That's due largely to insufficient screening of the sponsors they were sent to live with when they arrived in this country. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks may remember about 2.5 years ago, the very dramatic pictures of child migrants showing up at the southwest border who were coming here unaccompanied by themselves, migrating from Central America. And the federal agency that was responsible for the care of those children was so overwhelmed by the numbers that they ended up kind of streamlining the procedures that they had had in place, some for years, in order to more quickly place the children with people in the community. And that's what's really at issue here, is that because they weaken some of the child protection policies to vet the sponsors with whom these kids would be placed, some children fell into very dangerous situations.
What people may remember is there were tons of news sites just absolutely plastered with images of kids crammed into detention centers, sleeping side by side on floors because there weren't enough beds. And there really was a huge public outcry against those conditions. But it sounds like what's happened since then was part of an effort to ease that overcrowding. What kinds of protocols were loosened for the sake of expediency, for the sake of getting kids into homes?
That's exactly right, Gina. They rolled back these procedures in order to get the children out of the detention centers. So first, the government stopped fingerprinting most adults who were seeking to claim the children. And then in April 2014, in that spring, when things were starting to get very crowded on the border, the federal agency, which is under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, stopped requiring original copies of birth certificates to prove most sponsors' identities. And then the following month, it decided we don't need to complete forms that request sponsors' personal and identifying information before we send the children to sponsors' homes. And then finally, later that year, for a period, it eliminated FBI criminal history checks for many sponsors. So there's several periods of rollbacks over the course of about a year.
One of the kids you write about is a 14-year-old from Guatemala named Marvin Velasco. What was his story?
So Marvin had a very dangerous journey here to the U.S. He came up through the desert with smugglers. He was taken across a river, even though he doesn't swim. And he ended up in Texas in U.S. Border Patrol custody and then was sent to a sponsor's tiny apartment in Los Angeles.
And can I jump in and ask you, to your knowledge, what was he fleeing?
He was fleeing just a general situation of violence. He comes from a small border town on on the Guatemala-Mexico border. And he just decided that he didn't want to stay there. He hadn't been in school for a number of years either because he was working. He had family obligations to provide money for his smaller siblings. And the situation was just deteriorating in his home, and so he decided he might have a better life in the U.S.
Okay, so then he ends up in L.A.
Exactly. He ended up in L.A., and the U.S. government placed him with a very distant relative, the father of his brother-in-law. He had never met this man, but it turned out that man had really ill intentions. He basically didn't have the money to take care of Marvin. And so soon after he arrived at his crowded apartment where nine other people were living, he ended up depriving him of food. And so Marvin was sort of left in this crowded apartment by himself, weak and praying for his salvation. Fortunately, he was able to escape and has now found a safe new home with another immigrant family. But that was just one of the harrowing tales that I uncovered as a part of this investigation for AP.
Why, just thinking about the sponsors for a moment, why would a sponsor accept responsibility for a kid they either couldn't or didn't want to take care of?
Well, I think sponsors, many, many sponsors are responsible caregivers who want to do the right thing and provide some kind of shelter for migrant children who come here really without any support. When migrant children arrive by themselves, they're essentially in sort of an immigration limbo for a period. They are waiting to get their day in court and for a judge to decide whether they can, receive asylum or some other kind of legal status. And so the sponsors kind of fill this gap. Otherwise there aren't really any foster homes for these children to live in. So I think many sponsors hope to do the right thing, but perhaps after that realize, gosh, we really don't have the money or the time to really care for a troubled teen who has many needs and, is a much larger financial burden than we had expected. Of course, then there are people who just come into this with, really mal intent and never have even the pretense of doing the right thing.
Do the kids have any recourse? I mean, is anyone checking in on them once they're placed with sponsors?
So the federal government designates a small subset of the unaccompanied minors as being particularly vulnerable and allows social workers to check up on that small group of kids who may have undergone abuse or may in fact have been trafficked on their way to the United States. So a very small group of kids gets follow-up services, but even those kids who the government believes need extra protection sometimes vanish before social workers can reach them. So I spoke with a nonprofit that works with the government to provide these services, and they had tracked more than 200 cases in which children had ran away or the families couldn't be traced since 2013.
And you were saying this
sound very troubling.
You were saying this was a small subset, that there are people checking in on a very small subset of particularly vulnerable children. First of all, how small percentage-wise would you say this subset is? And secondly, what about everyone else?
At times, the subset has been as small as 4% of all unaccompanied minors. So that's a very, very small subset. It's now, I believe, about 10%. The number has oscillated some over time. But everyone else really receives very little follow-up. There's now a new procedure in place. HHS has said they have strengthened some of these policies that they weakened a couple of years ago. And so they now call the sponsors within a month of the child having been placed in the community. But even that, advocates say, is really insufficient to make sure that kids are doing okay, that sponsors are doing what they say they will do, that they're placing them in school, that they're making sure they have help in getting to court, that they're getting them health care, et cetera.
Well, we'll check in on with our local immigration lawyers shortly to hear whether that's all playing out as intended in our area. But how many kids were placed in dangerous settings after fleeing Central America and arriving in the U.S.? Do we know?
Well, you know, as part of the reporting I did, I found more than 24 children who were placed with sponsors who subjected them to sexual abuse, labor trafficking, or severe abuse and neglect. I spoke with lawyers for children who were forced to work in cantinas where women drink, dance, and sometimes have sex with patrons. I spoke to an attorney whose client was forced to work in a restaurant at night and clean houses on weekends and was locked in her home. Found some really very disturbing cases. And what advocates said is that this likely represents just the tip of the iceberg, because unfortunately, the federal government still doesn't have in place very detailed systems to track the welfare of the unaccompanied minors they place in the community. So no one thinks the majority of the unaccompanied minors who've come here have fallen into this kind of danger. But nonetheless, even that number, senators found very troubling.
Is anyone talking about solutions now that it's known what's going on?
Yeah, so the Senate Bipartisan Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations had a hearing on these issues a few weeks ago. They did their own separate investigation into the problems with the rollbacks of child protection in response to a labor trafficking case in Ohio. And so they are continuing to press the Department of Health and Human Services for more answers as to how the program is working now. Again, the agency says they've since strengthened it, and I'm sure we'll have some more material coming forth soon about what the agency's response has been. There have been some other House committees that have expressed interest in this as well, and I know that Senator Claire McCaskill, who is a top Democrat on the Senate committee, continues to be very, very engaged in these issues as well.
One of the people you talked to in the course of your reporting was Jacqueline Baba of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. You quote her as follows. She says, "We would never release domestic children to private settings with as little scrutiny." From a human rights standpoint, does the international community have any legal responsibility to take care of children regardless of citizenship status? Or does our obligation to protect kids domestically not extend to children from somewhere else?
Well, the federal agency under the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, has some obligations to care for children who come here by themselves, who are deemed to be uniquely vulnerable because they migrate without any relatives. But some of those duties stop, the agency argues, once the children are placed with sponsors. There's certainly international treaties that obligate nation states to care for child migrants, if you think of the EU and Syrian refugee kids. But the children coming here from Central America are not officially deemed as refugees. So that complicates things a bit further.
Garance Burke of the Associated Press, hang on tight. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear local stories from immigration lawyers based here in Kansas City. If you have a question for the experts on this morning's panel, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Remember about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when unaccompanied child migrants were arriving in the U.S. from Central America in droves? It was front and center in the news. We even had a conversation about the local impact here on this show. Well, today we've been checking in on whatever happened to those kids whose status was in limbo last we know, and it sounds like really still is. So far, we've gotten an update from the town of Liberal, Kansas, where more of these kids have settled than anywhere else in the state. We've also been talking with an investigative reporter for the Associated Press, Garance Burke, who wrote an expose on the children placed by authorities in unsafe homes. Now let's get some local immigration lawyers in on the discussion. Angie Williams, welcome back to Central Standard.
Thank you, Gina.
When we talk about child migrants here in Kansas City, who are we talking about? What are some of the commonalities in their stories?
For the most part, we're talking about kids usually between the ages of, at the youngest, I would say, well, in Kansas City at least, I mean, they come at all ages, but in Kansas City, the youngest I've seen is 10 or 11 to 17. Most of them are fleeing violence in their homes, either domestic violence themselves in their homes or a violent situation in the towns, like gang violence. Many of them are also coming to the United States because they had been left in their home country with a grandparent who now has either died or become too old to be able to take care of them. And usually also another factor, like violence in the town or something else has happened to cause them to now have to come to try to come to the United States to find another relative, a parent or a brother or sister or aunt or uncle or something like that. Those are who I've been seeing the most.
How do they find their way to you?
Usually after they get here and they've gone through the process like your previous guest was explaining and they've been placed with someone, they usually have gone to a court and then they've come to me either through a referral from another family member or through another community person.
What do you see as the possible outcomes for children arriving here in the U.S. under these circumstances? I mean, in the broadest sense, it seems like it would be a question of getting to stay here or being sent back. But can you give us a little more nuance than that?
Well, usually there's two different paths that they take. There can be some other paths occasionally, but the two most common are the special immigrant juvenile visas that we talked about or the political asylum. And one of those two avenues is usually what my clients tend to take, and it really just depends on the situation. The special immigrant juvenile visa is for kids that have been abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both of their parents. And that one is a fairly complicated process because it also requires getting an order from a state court, some kind of guardianship or dependency order from a state court. Kids really need a lawyer to be able to do that because then it also requires filing paperwork with immigration. I don't know how they could possibly manage to do that all on their own.
Legally, I mean, how is it determined what the outcome will be for one kid versus another? I mean, what are some of the real sticking points where there's a determination that legally needs to be made that could shift the whole discussion, the whole future for a human being?
Well, it really depends very factually on the situation. Some kids have very good asylum claims and some kids don't. Like, for example, kids that have suffered domestic violence or kids that have been directly you know, tried to be recruited by gangs or have been suffered some sort of persecution in some way may have a very good asylum claim, and that may be a better avenue for them, and may not have the special immigrant juvenile visa because they are here with both of their parents, for example. And some kids may not have the persecution aspect. They weren't ever threatened or anything like that, but they may have been abandoned by their parents or one of their parents, and they may be here with not a parent, and that may be a better avenue. So it's very fact specific.
What is going on with your clients largely right now? I mean, has anything changed since we spoke a little more than a year ago?
In terms of our court system is very backed up, and so a lot of them are just waiting. One of the things that your previous guest was talking about the being in this kind of terminal limbo and being in precarious situations once they get released, I find my clients in that particular situations, not necessarily because they were released to people with malintent, but even kids that were released to their parents. You know, you have to understand that sometimes these kids have not lived with their parents for years, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, and now all of a sudden they're reunited with a parent who has another life, and there's a real familial conflict in trying to reunite those two people. And sometimes there ends up being a second abandonment once the child gets here because there's a very strong family conflict. It's a very difficult family reunification, even when a child is reunified with a family member up here that has good intent.
And you mentioned that the courts are backed up. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, in Kansas City in particular, we recently had both of our prior judges retire, and so now we only have one judge at the moment, and so that has set us back a little bit more than usual. But for example, if you want to have a hearing, a normal hearing that's not on any kind of expedited docket, you can expect to get a trial date sometime in late 2017 or 2018 at this point.
Wow.
So
we're... And that, I mean, that could make the difference between whether someone is even still a minor.
That doesn't necessarily make any difference if they entered as a minor. Sometimes you can still retain that minor status depending on if you file at the right time and if you continue to file as a minor. But yes, they could be not minors anymore by the time they actually have their hearings.
Let's bring Michael Shaman Crawford in on this discussion. Like Angie Williams, he's a local immigration lawyer. Michael, does your experience align with Angie's, or are you seeing something else that you think it's important to address?
In broad general terms, I think we're consistent with what Angie has to say. I think some of the bigger issues that we're seeing from a litigation strategy standpoint is that the children are not seeking assistance in a timely manner. They are waiting until they go to court, which can be, as Angie said, a year or two down the road. And so windows of opportunities may be lost at that point. They may have
aged. Be fair, I put off doing my homework at that age.
Exactly. And the problem is that the parents put it off, the sponsor puts it off. And so in some sense, the 17-year-old is now 18, and so the opportunity for a special immigrant juvenile status is lost. We've gone past a year since their arrival, and we still don't have an asylum claim on file, and we have some difficulties with that. So there are some significant issues that arise out of that waiting. But to be fair, a lot of them are either, as the narrative indicated, they're in school or they're with their parents or whomever, and they've gone in immediately into the workplace. And so they simply don't have time, and they don't understand that. There's no follow-up to explain what the necessity is to find counsel, to get things moving, what their options are immediately. None of that advice has been given to anyone who has an interest in that child.
I asked AP reporter Garance Burke about follow-up with kids, like whether anyone was checking in on them while they were in this limbo, this legal limbo. Has your perception been that people are checking in on kids in Kansas City, in the Kansas City area, who are awaiting trial?
I don't know of any children that are being checked in on by a third party. It's up to whomever is responsible for them, and sometimes it's themselves, depending on their age and where they're at. And then hopefully once they've retained counsel or availed themselves of legal services, then that person or agency is helping them.
So it sounds like for a lot of people, whatever services are available, they may not even know about.
It's typical that they will get a handout of free, what's known as free legal service providers, which can be low bono, pro bono providers. But frequently, sometimes those are area specific. So if they're at a children's shelter in Phoenix, then those are going to be Phoenix related. When they move to Liberal, they may not have the list. And here in the area, the Kansas City court serves both Kansas and Missouri. So those children in the story from Liberal go to court in Kansas City, Missouri. And that list of free legal service providers or low-cost service providers may not have been provided to them until they make their first appearance at court. Well, now we're past a year, we're over 18, we have some issues that have arisen. Now they begin to seek out, whether it's the low bono and then they're referred out to someone else, it becomes a problem.
When you are interacting with these kids, trying to develop a case with them, what are some of the questions that you ask? What are some of the challenges of representing these kids legally? I mean, given their age, given the nature of their experiences.
A lot of it is trust building, just being able to converse with them and make them comfortable to tell the story, to ask questions non-judgmentally. We look at cases, as Angie said, to say, oh, this is a good case or this is a bad case, but we have to be interacting with them in a manner that doesn't seem to suggest what the answer to the question is, that we're eliciting the truth from them. And then we want to understand exactly what the facts are so that we can make the best decision possible.
What are some of the important things to demonstrate for a quote-unquote good case? And do kids always know the answers to the questions that you need answers to? I mean, when I think about just childhood, understanding what the pressures are that are acting on you from the outside world as a child, that is difficult. I mean, you might need decades to be able to understand that.
No, and I think part of the problem becomes is that the children have their own perspective of what their life is, that, as you indicated, a very childlike perspective. And so part of the problem becomes is filtering out the parent who may want to say, oh, well, this is going to happen to them, or this is what they're afraid of. But when you ask the child about life, they say, well, I lived with grandma and we did this, and the reason I'm here is because grandma became old. That's a completely different issue. Now, that's not to say that those facts aren't there. There are certainly dire country conditions that can be applied across some general spectrums of gender and age and those issues. So there are some attitudes that we can take to say this is their narrative, but here is what the reality of life is. Granted, they are isolated or insulated.
So it becomes incumbent upon you to demonstrate that there were dire circumstances that were being fled.
It can be. We've got several options. If you're looking at special immigrant juvenile status, we have some complicated issues in the sense that they've been brought here and they're living with a parent. If they're with a parent, we have a very narrow window to get that case in front of the state court, which is our first step. So if there are some issues that allow us to do that, then we can move in that regard. As far as an asylum claim, especially with the unaccompanied juveniles, this is an ever-changing area of law. There are some huge gaps, as we commonly call it political asylum and think of the Cuban baseball team vanishing from the Olympics. It's really more nuanced than that. This is persecution based on race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, and political opinion. And so in nomenclature, we seize on the political opinion, but in actuality, the particular social group aspect is much broader, and it is a social, it's a group that society defines, and then we have to say, well, which society? That society from which they come. And then what is an immutable characteristic, which is that defining issue? Gender clearly is one of those, and as we explore conditions in Central and South America, there is a disparate treatment of genders, and that becomes a very large social group to step into, but also one that the government is loath to allow us to step into. So there's a considerable amount of litigation saying, for example, that women or girls or females are a particular social group just amongst themselves.
How would gender play into an argument that someone is has a good case for asylum?
If the daughter has been left behind, has been forced to do housework, but it's not abusive, but she's being sheltered into a specific social given role model, that gang members or older men or are allowed to be around her and begin to interact with her. simply because, well, she's the girl, that's what's expected of her, and those become problematic. Those stories children can tell, well, this is the way it is because this is what I believe. But yet that disparate treatment, that inability to move forward, or that treatment in a specific manner solely based on gender, and the little and the boys are the same. They're going to be recruited by the gangs. They're going to be viewed in this manner. It's either work or gang membership, and education is a part that's going to get thrown to the wayside. Those are specific issues that we can address.
Angie, I know that, you know, clients have a confidentiality. Is there a story that you are able to tell that taps into some of these issues that Michael's raising?
There are many of them. I think one of the most common ones, at least among my female clients, is specifically related to gender. One of the most common stories that I hear is some sort of some man in a gang decided that he wanted me to be his girlfriend, and I didn't want to. And so he started following me around, and he started making threats against me, and he started saying that if I wasn't his girlfriend, he was going to kidnap my son, or he was going to rape me, or something like that. And so now it's more of a gender issue, in that women were in that particular society are viewed as property. Like, he got to have her as his girlfriend, and that was it. There's very little recourse for women in Central America to be able to go to the police to report rape or sexual assaults or stalking or even domestic violence, and to be able to do anything about it. So I think that's one of the most common issues that I see, that's a non, like, marital domestic violence relationship.
I want to ask you both the same question I asked our reporter, Grance Burke, a little while ago. Is there a sense that someone who is that someone is responsible for the safety and protection of children, no matter where they come from? I mean, and who within the United States is responsible for protecting children legally?
I think there should be, certainly. I mean, I think children are the most vulnerable segment of our population. There's all sorts of laws. You know, one of the reasons that we can, if a Mexican child comes to our border, that we can send the Mexican child back, is because Mexico's right there and we can give them back custody to the Mexican government. But we can't do the same thing for Central American children because they're not right there. We can't, there's nobody to take custody of them. There's protections for that. There's reasons that we have these protections in place, but it doesn't seem like there's any sort of follow up. Like Michael, I've never had anybody say, oh, so-and-so from the ORR called to see how I was doing. I didn't even know that was existed until your first guest said that actually supposedly happens. I'd never even heard of that.
I don't think there's a sense of I think we as Americans are fortunate in the sense that we don't have a lot of pre-existing conflict around us. We're not the Middle East. We're not even Europe. We're not those places where we see influx and entry and egress of migrants at that scale, fleeing specific. So we don't have that sense of refugee. So we haven't had an idea that says we have a large number of foreign children that we need to take care of. I don't think it's been part of the dialogue. And I think that's part of the problem that caught everyone flat-footed in the last couple of years. And those resources don't exist. So now it's a question of how much are we willing to do this, and then who is going to step up to that? Clearly, it's abhorrent to stick them all in a camp, even though the camp may have education and good food and medical care. It still is a terrible image. But by the same token, those children that are released to family members who, as Angie well stated, maybe, yes, we're reuniting the family, but that family's been ununited for 10 years. So now you're taking a teenager and thrusting them into the authority of parents that they haven't seen. And there are issues of abandonment. There are issues of anger. We have all sorts of issues. And there's no resource to follow up with that. It's just a matter of, this is the first taste that we've had of it. And I don't know that anybody is prepared for it.
Part of the issue, it does sound like, is whether we are calling these migrants or refugees, which is a huge question that could probably be an hour-long discussion in and of itself, but what is the basic difference and why can't we seem to develop like cultural consensus around that?
I think the big issue is that we aren't willing to label them as specifically fleeing one of those five grounds of persecution, the refugees. We can tend to say they are political dissidents, those people that are fleeing the Assad regime or fleeing because they are going to be singled out as enemies of the regime. And there is a political nexus to that. And so it's easy to call them refugees because they fall cleanly within that category. This sense of generalized crime in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala is one that doesn't fit so cleanly within those definitions. So it becomes difficult to say, well, they're fleeing violence and therefore they're refugees. Well, but that's not an easy definition. And again, as I said, they don't want to pick one. We don't want to say, well, they're women that are fleeing or that they're young men that are fleeing. And there are a lot of nuances between the countries to say El Salvador's violence may be a different nature based on that country. So it may be more political than Guatemala's is, which may lend it to a definition. But again, as you can see, it gets to be very esoteric, and we could probably spend 2 hours.
Angie, do you think the proximity of Central America and possibly even a really persistent narrative of people crossing that border south of the U.S. for economic reasons rather than to flee imminent danger has anything to do with how we in the U.S. tend to see these kids?
Yes, I do. I think that one of the reluctance to calling any of the people refugees rather than migrants is because I think there's a fear that if we start calling them refugees, then we'll have to call them refugees. We'll have to treat them as refugees and not treat them like illegal immigrants, which is what I think people would rather treat them as, people trying to come here to work. And because I hear in the news a lot of people trying to call them economic migrants rather than asylum seekers. And just because, you know, by and large in my practice, the people that come that have come seeking counsel, they may not all have great asylum claims, but they all have asylum claims. They all have fled something. And just because they don't necessarily have a great asylum claim doesn't mean that they weren't fleeing. And so I think that's a big difference. And I think that that's one of the things, you know, if we start calling them refugees, then we have to call them refugees and treat them like that.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll wrap up this conversation about unaccompanied minors from Central America, many of whom have been in limbo for years. You've still got just a minute to call up if you have a question, 816-235-2888. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're catching up on what's happening with the child migrants or unaccompanied minors who arrived in the U.S. more than a year ago as part of a wave of flight, largely from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. For National Perspective, we're joined by AP reporter Garance Burke. We're also talking with local immigration lawyers Angie Williams and Michael Sharma Crawford. Garance, I want to turn back to you, first of all, to hear what your response is to the stories you're hearing about people in Kansas City. Do they reflect what you're seeing in your reporting nationally? I know your focus is on abuse. It's a very sharply focused investigation you did. But I wonder what echoes you're hearing nationally or if you're hearing something specific about Kansas City that might stand out.
Well, I think one of the things that was most interesting about Esther's report is the way in which she highlighted the challenges that unaccompanied minors face who are settled in rural areas. And as your other guests were saying, for kids who need to drive 6-8 hours in order to appear before an immigration judge, it makes all of these issues that they're facing even more difficult. So, you know, I think one of the interesting things about Kansas and Missouri is that, you know, as a percentage of overall minors, not that many unaccompanied kids have been settled in either state. But they may make up, you know, a larger percentage of the kids in school, for instance, which can pose unique challenges for districts that, say, don't have a really robust ESL program before, you know, 50, 60 kids arrive who don't speak English as a first language. So I think all of these issues are very similar to other places around the country where you don't have a huge concentration of services that are already in place to help unaccompanied minors, such as might be the case in Houston or Los Angeles, for instance.
Looking forward, I mean, where do you see the national conversation headed around this?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest on Capitol Hill in how HHS is now managing the program. The federal agency says that they're better prepared to accommodate the latest wave of child migrants, including preparing to add more than 2,000 shelter beds where children can stay while awaiting placement. They've also set up a national call center where children and sponsors can report problems. But, you know, as crime and violence are deepening in Central America, folks are really worried that you know, we still don't quite have the system in place that we need in order to accommodate this latest wave of kids arriving here by themselves.
And then previous waves are, is there an active conversation about previous waves that are still, as we've been hearing, really in limbo?
Yes, I think both senators and folks in the House are really trying to get more answers about how those kids have fared, the children who have been resettled with sponsors since late 2013. And, you know, school districts, of course, are accommodating those kids in different ways. They are showing up in courts in our cities nationwide. And so I think there are various ways in which unaccompanied minors are intersecting with some of the, you know, the infrastructure of U.S. government schools, et cetera, in this country, but still not quite enough answers from the federal agency that is responsible for their care when they first arrive about, you know, how exactly those children have fared and whether they're able to adequately track their welfare.
Angie, do you see the school systems locally, local educators getting involved in your clients' cases, clients who are young?
I do. I have teachers calling me all the time saying both, I mean, on all sorts of immigration issues, not just the unaccompanied minor issues. It's very common that teachers call me about their children in their schools when they find out that they have some sort of immigration situation going on, for any immigration situation.
Would you say that school is a primary place where unaccompanied minors or children who are wrapped up in any kind of immigration process are, as Garance put it, intersecting with the U.S. infrastructure?
Yeah, and I think it's one of the places where they may have the first chance to interact with a sort of an authority figure that they may feel safe with, that they can build trust with these teachers. They can build trust with this sort of authority figure that may represent even someone that knows what to do or where to get some help. And they may be able to, and those teachers or administrators or counselors or something like that may be able to help facilitate some of this. I think that might be a good place to help, you know, put in some safety checks. I know that I get calls monthly, if not weekly, from teachers worried about their students.
Michael, as we wrap up our conversation, I wonder if there is a single challenge or a single, like, what you see as a possible opportunity for this process to in some way shift that we should be keeping in mind just as we move the conversation forward.
We have to examine what it is we want to do and how we want to treat them. As we've debated, are they refugees? Are they not refugees? The infrastructure of these children's representatives, their allies, is being stretched. And as Garance put it, it's the percentage of children here is relatively small. But when you consider that there are probably five low bono, pro bono service providers on the immigration courts list, one of which is from Kansas City to is in Kansas City, so serves from Springfield to the Kansas border. We're stretched to the limit. That clinic is run by our firm. We have one attorney. We expanded to cover asylum claims. It's run by low bono fees. We have no funding. It's difficult to adequately represent them. For Angie to represent them, she either drops fees or does it pro bono and takes away from her own income. It's stretching everyone. And so we're having trouble adequately defending them. That's really the other view of the coin.
Yeah. I know almost every attorney that I know takes these pro bono or low bono.
Our time is sadly up for this conversation about child migrants from Central America in Kansas City and beyond. Angie Williams, Michael Sharma Crawford, I appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Garance Burke, AP reporter, thanks for sharing your perspective.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you missed Esther Honig's story about the significant population of unaccompanied minors in Liberal, Kansas, check that out on our website, kcur.org, and listen to anything you heard on today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, the Folk Alliance's International Conference has begun. Last year, we tried to define folk music. We are not easily discouraged, and this year, we are going to define world music. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman.